From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Chernia.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And as we are coming up on Earth Day, which is next Monday, we are going to be discussing its history and this year's theme for Earth Day, which is Planet versus Plastics, according to EarthDay.org.
Yes.
And we are going to be speaking with Aiden Sharon, who is the director of End Plastic Initiatives at EarthDay.org.
All right. Then in the second part of the show, Dr. Jade Sasser joins us to talk about her newly released book, Climate Anxiety and the Kid Question, Deciding Whether to Have Children in an Uncertain Future. Dr. Sasser offers the first comprehensive study of how environmental conditions spark emotions that influence if, when, and why people today decide to become parents. Dr. Sasser finds that attitudes towards reproduction, particularly in marginalized communities, are often influenced by environmental conditions, degradation, and now climate change. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And we are excited to welcome our first guest as we embark on 2024's Earth Day next Monday, Chris. And we have with us Aiden Sharon, who is the director of End Plastic Initiatives at EarthDay.org. Thank you for joining us, Aiden.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're glad to have you on board here. And I think I want to kick it off. It's always interesting to hear a little bit about Earth Day and how it all began. What was the impetus to it, and then where we stand now? So why don't you kind of take us through the history first?
Yeah, sure thing. So decades before the first Earth Day, air pollution was considered the smell of prosperity. And then in 1962, Rachel Carson published Silent Spring, highlighting and raising public awareness and concern for living organisms, the environment, and the links between pollution and public health. Come 1969, Senator Gaylord Nelson, the junior senator from Wisconsin, wanted to do something about it, and after witnessing a massive oil spill in January 69, set out to use the momentum gathered by the anti-war movement and the public consciousness around air and water pollution, and announced an idea to do a series of teach-ins on college campuses. With Pete McCloskey, a conservation-minded Republican congressman serving as co-chair, they pushed for our founder, Dennis Hayes, who acts as our board chair emeritus now, to do these teach-ins and organize campus teach-ins across the United States. And with the first Earth Day taking place on April 22nd, 1970, they were able to recruit 20 million Americans, which is about 10% of the population, was 10% of the population of the United States at the time. And from there, we've just continued to grow. 1990, we went international. We've been doing themes since the 1980s. And this year, our theme is Planet versus Plastics.
And that is something that you have been studying for many years now. And you are the director of End Plastic Initiatives at EarthDay.org. What is your position there? And can you tell us about this theme and why it's so important?
Yeah, so my position on plastics is we need to start phasing them out. I know they are, you know, considered a really useful material, but the issue is we know so little about them. We know, scientists have known for 30 years that they cause endocrine disruption at some level or another, but we're finally waking up to the cause, and people in the general public are finally realizing this material that's surrounding us, we know so little about. And then a lot of people, what people don't realize is that plastics are made up of 99% fossil fuels, and the petrochemical industry and the fossil fuel industry have really just been pushing us not to realize that, and just kind of pushing those fossil fuels on us, as well as the chemicals associated with them. So inside of plastic, there's a potential for over 16,000 different chemicals, 4,200 of which are considered highly dangerous to people. And that's just the ones we've studied. We've only, you know, reviewed like 5,000 of them. So we have another 11,000 that we just haven't looked into that I'm sure have a potential to be dangerous to our human health.
Yeah, obviously human health, but of course environmental health too. So give us a sense of the scale of the impact with at this point, the ubiquity of plastics around the planet, you know, air, land, and sea?
Yeah, so plastics are everywhere, unfortunately. The reason because of this is they break down into just smaller pieces. They never really biodegrade completely. So they break down into microplastics, which then enter into our waterways, which enter into our oceans. But they also have the potential to be picked up in the air and then enter us via inhalation, as well as being picked up by different species of animals, and they enter the food web in that way. When I was going through my undergrad, I was shown one of my first classes a dinoflagellate, which is just a small microorganism eating a piece of plastic. That piece of plastic is consumed by the dinoflagellate. The dinoflagellate's eaten by a fish and just moves up the food web in that way, eventually leading to, you know, the apex predators and the top predators, including us, being full of these plastics. That's not to include the macroplastics. You know, we have the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is comprised mostly of plastic that will not break down. It's just circling in the Pacific Ocean, as well as those macroplastics are clogging the digestive tracts of all species of animal in our oceans and on land. So we even have, you know, ants in some parts of the world being ensnared by tiny little fibers of plastic, and then we have whales consuming large amounts of plastic via fishing nets. Unfortunately, it's not a digestible product, so those animals tend to die.
Right, they're dying because the plastics collect in some, they're not broken down. Unless they can be passed through the animal's system, they, like you say, they just accumulate and then become not just maybe a chemical toxin, but just a physical obstruction inside these animals' bodies.
Yeah, and it's difficult for that to break down because, I mean, our biological system isn't made, and no animal's biological system is really adapted to break down these plastics. If they're not getting any nutrition out of it, they're not able to pass it through, so it's just building up and eventually killing them.
So EarthDay.org has set a pretty big ask. They want to reduce the production of all plastics by 2040. Can you tell us how those initiatives are being met or what you would like to see happen?
Yeah, we're calling for a 60% reduction of production of plastics by 2040 from the current levels. As we were doing the research for these reports we've been coming out with, we realized that, you know, 50% of all plastic is single use. So you use it once, you throw it away, it never breaks down, it just lives in the environment forever. So if we just got rid of single use plastic, that's 50% of our production right there. Leaving just 10%, we have to figure out whether that's going back towards more reusable containers, finding a different alternative to plastic that is healthy, or just looking back towards more recyclable materials such as cardboard or aluminum. So we at EarthDay.org believe that this is an easy step, and what we're calling on is international leaders to focus on the global plastics treaty and really start thinking about human and environmental health by reducing the production of plastic and coming up with upstream solutions rather than relying on the false narrative that is recycling. Unfortunately, only 9% of all plastic has been recycled. It's not the consumer's fault at all. I want to reiterate that pretty heavily. The consumer is not at fault for believing that plastic can be easily recycled. Industry has done a good job of kind of greenwashing it. And the reason it can't be easily recycled is just the massive amount of chemicals that go into it and the various amount of chemicals that go into plastic.
That's really interesting, of the kind of growing perspective that for decades, literally decades, you know, starting in the 80s when recycling programs took off with respect to plastic, as I remember, it was, well, we got to recycle our plastic, not just throw it away and not just avoid it, but, you know, use it and make sure we recycle it. But you're saying that's your words, false narrative, and the fact that after all these decades, still very little plastic actually gets recycled. Talk a little bit more about that idea that it's not working in a way.
Yeah, it's not working because plastic is such a complex material, and it's also not just one material. So while it's made up 99% of it is made up of fossil fuels. It's also the additive chemicals that make it different. So your water bottle that might be reusable, which is great, we're calling everybody to have reusable materials, is going to be a different type of plastic than, say, your stapler on your counter. Just looking around my office and trying to figure out, like, oh, my laptop's a different plastic than my monitor. My monitor is a different plastic than my phone. Mm-hmm. All of them require different ways to get recycled, and that makes waste systems extremely complex and makes figuring all this out extremely expensive. And all these chemicals can't be broken down in the same way. So we have seen, you know, you see the triangle with a different number. Some of those triangles with the different numbers are more easily recyclable than others, but the majority of plastic just isn't recyclable. So we just need to move away from it as a material. We could also, if we wanted to figure out recycling, we just need to figure out what materials and what chemicals are absolutely necessary for plastic that aren't going to be harmful to our health and aren't going to be harmful to the environment, and just condense it down to some key chemicals that we know how to process, we know how to worry about, and then add some transparency around the material.
Right. I guess we need to be fair, too, because plastics play really important roles in our lives. In certain industries and the pharmaceutical industry uses plastic. So not that we're going, you know, the goal here is to do away with plastics entirely, but do away with the wasteful use of it, or exactly. Look for the efficiencies that we can employ that use less plastic.
Yeah, it's figuring out where plastic is absolutely necessary and then figuring out where we don't need plastic. We don't need as much packaging on everything. We don't need wasteful water bottles in most parts of the world. We don't need, you know, wasteful plastic wrappers, clamshell packaging on nearly everything we use nowadays, and we just throw it away without a second thought. There are some industries like the medical industry that, you know, do require some more plastic, but I speak with representatives of those communities all the time, and they tell me they use way too much plastic. There are some areas they could cut back, whether that's in the hospital, you know, using more reusable containers for water and things like that, but also just reducing packaging. Packaging is one of the largest issues of plastic, and we've just become so used to it, and I think it appears to be cleaner to us when something's wrapped in that plastic packaging, but in reality, it's leaching, you know, thousands of different chemicals into us that we have no idea what they're going to do in the long run. We're just starting to scratch the surface on the research around the health dangers of plastic. And I think wrapping our food and wrapping the things we touch on a daily basis in it is just not the way to go.
And we are speaking with, if you've just joined us, Aidan Charron, who is the director of End Plastic Initiatives at EarthDay.org. And this year for Earth Day, EarthDay.org has stated that it is a planet versus plastics theme. And we've been talking about how I think we got into this world of plastics and we really didn't understand the implications. But as you said, Chris, there is growing concern. And I think the next generation really is keying in on taking better care of our earth, and they're also looking for ways to reuse, recycle in a sure. good way. And so, Aidan, are you seeing this, and what kind of momentum are you seeing from this younger generation? And I guess we know that there are a lot of issues that we have caused, but what do you see as hopeful for us in the future?
I think we're really going to start seeing a cut down on plastic production and kind of a calling out of the perpetrators of the massive amount of waste we have in our society and our systems. We're seeing some movement in the global community. We have the Global Plastics Treaty going on, or the UN Plastics Treaty, depending on it if you're a lawyer or not. I am not, so I refer to it as the Global Plastics Treaty, which is more palatable. And the next set of negotiations, Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee, will be taking place over Earth Day between April 20th and April 29th in Ottawa, Canada. And what we're seeing there is countries kind of pushing and realizing that while plastic can be great in some circumstances, we have too much, so it's time to come up with an international treaty to kind of start mitigating plastic pollution as a whole. And the only way we're going to mitigate plastic pollution is to cut down on production. I also, you know, this may be a little more anecdotal, but in my community and the people I speak with of the younger generation, we're starting to move away from using as much plastic. So we're trying to, you know, push companies to realize we don't want this crap in our house. We're done with it. We're tired of having this massive piles of plastic anytime we order a package. We're tired of seeing grocery bags floating across our cities and across our towns. And then also there's a push now that has come out in the last couple of years to move away from fast fashion. So while fast fashion took off, you know, 5 years ago, I want to say it, I'm not a very fashionable person. I'm currently wearing a t-shirt for my job. Mm-hmm. But we're starting to see a move away from those fast fashion as a whole, because people are realizing it's just mostly made up of plastic with artificial fibers, and it's just falling apart. It's just not economical to keep buying it. So we're starting to look towards, you know, more sustainable materials, and then also just thrifting more and start reusing clothing more.
And as we do approach Earth Day, it's coming up next Monday on April 22nd. I know that you say on your website that it's not a day, it's a movement, and we do want to be conscious of how we are treating our planet each day. But what are some things that, as Earth Day comes up, that people can really focus on or do in their communities, or what are some of the suggestions that your website has?
Yeah, people, I'm sure, are tired of hearing environmentalists say this all the time, and I've said it like 4 times since talking with y'all, but reuse, reuse, reuse. It's constantly mentioned by environmentalists and those looking to cut back where they can, because it's one of the most important things an individual can do. You know, opt for a stainless steel or glass water bottle and food containers. In the long run, you're going to end up saving some money because you're not purchasing as many single-use water bottles. Other things to do, in my life, we recently ran a plastic audit of your house. So take a log of what plastic you're using every day. It's impossible to make those adjustments without knowing where you're using the most amount of plastic. It could be the constant use of saran wrap on food that reusable alternatives could easily replace, like a beeswax canvas wrapper. And then you can also find the most common plastic you're tossing out and look for those alternatives. And pay attention to where you're buying your clothes and what they're made out of. A lot of us don't realize those materials in a lot of our clothes are made up of plastic, and it's just shedding microfibers into our air that we're inhaling, that we're consuming, that are entering our water streams, that are entering the animals on our planets, as well as the children that are running around. And then push for local legislature that cuts down on plastic. I'm from the Outer Banks of North Carolina. We used to have a plastic bag ban on our beaches, and it was really evident that our beaches were cleaner. Unfortunately, that bag ban was repealed, and I talked to my father the other day, and he mentioned to me, like, hey, why are there so many plastic bags floating around again? I thought we solved this, but it's because we repealed that bag ban, leading to those bags penetrating our ecosystem once again.
Hold on there, because you say we, the North Carolina legislature, repealed the bag ban. Is that right?
Well, it was a local legislation.
It was a local legislation. Okay.
It was a local legislation for Dare County, North Carolina. But there are preemptive bans on bag bans taking place all over the country. I believe North Carolina is one of those states that have issued a preemptive ban on bag bans, preventing local legislators from being able to ban plastic bags and plastic materials moving forward, which is a huge issue in our eyes because we're trying to cut down on plastic as a whole. A lot of businesses and a lot of communities will cite that plastic can save us money, but in reality, it costs us more than it saves. It's not the upfront cost, it's the afterthought cost. So the collecting of the waste and then also the cost on our healthcare system. Annually, the U.S. spends about $250 billion towards solving issues related to plastic and health. That's from the rise in cancer rates. That's from the rise in, you know, mental issues. That's from the rise in just endocrine disruption, which is the main cause of all of these issues. So while it does save a little money up front, the back end is the taxpayers are ending up having to pay more in the long run.
Right. I guess it's easier for an individual to quantify the savings up front than it is to quantify the environmental harm and the human harm on the back end, because no one contracts blood-borne diseases or other diseases and cites plastics as a microplastics as a reason, but that plays a role in our respiratory and cardiological health, et cetera. But that's difficult to quantify because it's a compounding factor.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult to quantify, and it's just, you know, it's intentional. Like, yeah, the industry doesn't want us to be aware that those are some underlying issues that are coming about, and those are some underlying costs that are accruing on us, the taxpayers, and us, the people.
Just a couple more minutes. What parameters are, say, you monitoring to, you know, determine or see potential success? And what parameters can we monitor? And I guess you've alluded to several of them. Can we monitor in our homes to say, "Ooh, I'm doing the right thing here. I'm using less plastic." Can you give us a sense of that?
Yeah, it's moving away from plastic. I think the best first step is to move away from the plastic that's touching our food. So, okay, you know, those plastic Tupperwares we have, I know they're really convenient, they're really great, but they do leach chemicals into our foods that we're not aware of, especially when we're running them through the microwave. The U.S. has a large leftover culture, so it might be time to move towards, you know, a glass container to store your food. Glass has been shown to be inert. It's not made up of a whole bunch of chemicals compared to plastic, so it's safer. Other things is just saran wrap and plastic wrap are such a huge issue, and they're not necessary. Like, we can find alternatives. You know, aluminum foil is a safer alternative. While it might cost a little bit more, move towards a reusable, you know, beeswax covered thing instead, a beeswax canvas wrap. I have one wrapped a sandwich somewhere on my desk. It's just little things like that to move forward, and then try to reuse. Have a reusable water bottle. Single-use water bottles are a huge issue. I believe it's 250,000 particles of microplastic are found in those water bottles, in one single water bottle. And that's just entering straight into your body, causing unknown damages that we're not going to be aware of, and you're not going to be aware of for years. You're just not going to think about it until one day some issue pops up that you're like, what could have caused this? And not even a lot of doctors are aware of what causes it. And the only way to prevent it is to move away from plastic.
So all good information for all of us to absorb and to think about how we live on a day-to-day basis and how plastics entering our lives.
Absorb that information rather than absorb the plastic.
Exactly. Absorb this information and act upon it. And where can people go to find out more about your organization and what you're doing?
So we keep it pretty easy, wordforearthday.org. And if you just go directly to earthday.org, you can find all of this information. We recently put out a babies versus plastic report, as well as a report on the importance of climate education globally. You can also check out our event map on there to find a local cleanup or other local events taking place on Earth Day and beyond. Because like you alluded to earlier, Earth Day isn't just one day. We try to push it every single day and just reduce our plastic use and reduce our waste and reduce our effect on the environment as a whole.
Well, you're speaking our language, Aiden. That's what we as try always. To do here every Tuesday on KPCW on this Green Earth. So thank you much for joining us. We really appreciate you. And I'm interested in looking into some of the studies that you have placed on there as well. So thank you so much. And hopefully we can have you back in another date.
Thanks, Aiden.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And happy Earth Day.
Thank you.
Happy Earth
Same
Day.
All right, let's take a break for a couple underwriters or so. And when we come back, we'll be speaking with Dr. Jade Sasser about her new book, Climate Anxiety and the Kid Question, Deciding Whether to Have Children in an Uncertain Future. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back. Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us for the second part of this show is Dr. Jade Sasser. She is Associate Professor of Gender and Sexuality Studies at the University of California, Riverside. She also has a PhD, among other things, in environmental science, policy, and management. But we're here to talk about her newly released book, Climate Anxiety and the Kid Question, Deciding Whether to Have Children in an Uncertain Future. Dr. Sasser, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with a little memory I have about kid anxiety. Let me put it this way. I'm a baby boomer, so I grew up 60s and 70s, and among all the TV I watched, I would watch All in the Family. And there is an episode, I don't know if it was a full episode, where the two younger couple, Gloria and Mike, were considering having children. And they decided not to have children, roughly speaking. And the reason they gave at that time was not so much, well, it was concerns over overpopulation and some environmental issues. But the biggest concern back then, anxiety about having children in the future, was with the specter of nuclear war, and not, you know, a purposeful event, but an accidental event of missiles, because that, you know, there were tens of thousands of missiles. So I go back and I see anxiety to have children back in the 60s and 70s through generation and generation. But now, in addition to that, we have climate change playing a role in generations considering to have children and the value or the benefits thereof. So I just wanted to share with you that I, as a baby boomer, I grew up with some levels, but now these generations X, Y, and Z have additional anxieties associated with them. And I guess maybe that's what your book is about?
Yes, and I do want to say that there have, as you said, been many generations that have worried about bringing children in. I think if we look across time, across history, there's no perfect time to have children, mm-hmm. but some moments feel a lot worse than others. And so what is going on with a lot of young people today, particularly Generation X and younger members of the millennial generation, is that they are very scientifically literate and very climate literate. Mm. And so they're actually consuming the scientific literature on climate change. They're consuming the forecast reports, the projections. They're reading reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC. And when they consume all of this information, they're looking at what the future ahead will bring. And they're making these personal calculations and saying, if I know that these really, really challenging times are coming environmentally, why would I knowingly bring a new child right. into that? It's one thing when you're unexpectedly experiencing challenges, right? And there are a number of challenges, I think, in our society that maybe are unexpected. The level of social and political polarization that we are in and have been in for a number of years, I think, has been surprising to a lot of people. The number of economic crises, financial crises that we've been shocked by since 2008 have been somewhat unexpected for a lot of people. But if we know that this climate crisis is long-term, enduring, and will in some ways simply get worse over a period of a number of years or decades, their question is, from a moral and ethical perspective, how could you bring someone new into that? And I think that that's different from the baby boomer concern around nuclear war, which right. my own parents shared that concern. They weren't sure whether they were going to have my sister or me because of those concerns. Mm. But I think the difference here with climate change is that we have some realistic expectation of what will happen, and we have some idea of the enduring time scale. So even if all the changes that needed to happen right now to really turn the tide on climate change, if that all happened today, it would still take decades to play out. So again, for young people, this is a moral and ethical question.
So when you were researching for the book, can you kind of walk us through who you were speaking to, what that demographic looked like?
Yes. So the book draws on research of two kinds, qualitative interviews and a quantitative national survey. The quantitative interviews were conducted among people who were college educated, but because I wanted to ensure that I was talking to people who knew something about environmental problems and had a reasonable handle on the basic science of climate change. With that said, they were a fairly diverse group, racially, ethnically. I spoke to predominantly people of color, but not exclusively so. I spoke to predominantly people who do not have children, though not exclusively so. Mm. And I asked them questions about how they feel about climate change, what emotions come up for them when they read the science or read the projection information, or when they simply experience wildfires, storms, or floods. And then I also asked them how they felt about having children, raising children, and how they feel about the future in that context. And everyone had distressing emotions around climate change, but what I found differently in this book is that people who were people of color felt the most distress. Hmm. For them, they felt that a number of ongoing deep social challenges leave them feeling vulnerable economically, socially, politically. And that climate change on top of that feels traumatizing. It feels like an overwhelming challenge that just can't be surmounted in addition to everything else. And that finding was also borne out in the survey. In the survey, people of color were most likely to report feeling trauma, which was the most distressing emotion that was identified by people in the survey.
Wow. And so as a result, are they right now, are they making the conclusion, drawing conclusions like, I don't think I want to have kids at this point? They're just kind of moving forward with that attitude?
No. So that was the interesting part. And there was quite a bit of diversity around that. The main conclusion that people were drawing in my study was that they feel deeply ambivalent to the point, really, of almost paralysis. Hmm. These were people who largely very much want children, want families. Some of my interviewees grew up with large, happy families, and they want to have that for themselves. Others did not, but they see having children as an important and very positive sign of hopefulness in the future. I did interview some people who were very clear that they do not want children, will never have them, and are very happy with that decision, but they were in the small minority. Most people were ambivalent. Most people were deeply, deeply ambivalent. It's not a settled question for many, many young people.
Okay. So in the book's acknowledgement, you write that you thank a certain class in the winter of 2023 that you had. It says that the day you all collectively melted down, the students collectively melted down in a giant pool of climate and reproductive anxiety. That was one of the turning points for you, to motivation to write this book. What happened in that class, and what did you learn?
I have never had that kind of experience in a classroom before. I had been doing the research for this book for a while. It was a research methods class. I shared some of the qualitative data in the class, and we together analyzed that data, and I was teaching them data analysis techniques. After we finished that exercise, I just thought, well, why don't I open up a broader conversation? So I simply said, have any of you ever felt this way, the way that you see people in these interviews describing their own experiences? And I thought I was going to open the door for maybe a brief conversation. I didn't know what to expect. This was a generally very quiet classroom of students. All I did was ask that question, and they erupted. They were very upset. Some of them were loud. Some of them were crying. Some of them expressed a sense of hopelessness and said, why should we strive toward anything? all we see in the future is more of what we're having right now, which is really, it feels like a catastrophe. They express that they don't know how long planet Earth will be a sustainable place for human life. And they said, why would we bring kids into that? But they also contextualized it within a broader sense of feeling extremely vulnerable within a society. They felt like they weren't sure that they would be able to get good, well-paying jobs when they graduate. They weren't sure that they would ever be able to afford to buy homes for their families. And so as part of that, but in addition to it, they said climate change just is so overwhelming. We can't solve this problem ourselves. Why should we even try? There was a lot of feeling of overwhelm in that classroom. Yeah. And there was a lot of feeling of anger, too. A number of students said, there's so much pressure on us to solve these problems for other people, for other generations. And a lot of older people tell us that they look to us to really solve the big environmental problems of the day. And we feel that it's not fair because we haven't had as much of a hand in creating those problems. So there were a lot of feelings in the class that day, and it took me by surprise. Mm. And for me, it was just a stronger indication that this book really needed to be written.
I just got a text in actually from a listener who was wondering how this generation is absorbing information, how that plays a role, how media plays a role, and what they're watching and what they're taking in at this rapid fire rate.
It plays a tremendous role, actually. And so one of the things that I advocate at a certain point in the book is that young people step back and not consume quite as large a volume of information all the time. It's not that they're consuming the wrong information or that it's factually inaccurate, but sometimes simply communicating facts about really distressing things can lead to emotional distress. And there have been a number of studies that have shown that the more people consume distressing news about climate change, it has a lasting negative impact on their emotional and mental state. So it is important to take a step back and maybe not consume news in high volume. But what is also important, and I discovered this through interviews with people in the book, what is also important is forming community with other people who are climate aware, climate concerned, perhaps who are organizers or activists, taking a stance, taking a position, making change, but also coming together with those folks to just be. A lot of young people feel a lot of pressure to take action all the time, but sometimes communities that are formed around simply just coming together around shared values and just being can be really, really helpful. And there are more of those groups that are forming. They're called climate cafes, and people are coming together to share their experiences with climate anxiety and climate distress. Not to necessarily take any specific action to solve it, but to simply find community, decrease stigma, decrease isolation, and figure out a way forward together.
We're speaking with Dr. Jade Sasser. She is an associate professor of gender and sexuality studies at the University of California, Riverside. And we're talking about her newly released book, Climate Anxiety and the Kid Question, Deciding Whether to Have Children in an Uncertain Future. And you said something really interesting that kind of resonated with me, is that, you know, we like to see the latest generation taking action on climate. And when kids are out picking up litter and writing papers and writing little op-eds and letters, these are the ones we showcase. And that, in a way, though, Dr. Sasser, if I have this right, it can add pressure to them to want to, in a sense, solve the problem that we boomers like me helped create decades ago.
Yes, it does increase a sense of pressure. Every time I have spoken about the research for this book, and I primarily speak to college students, I always ask the question, do any of you ever feel pressured by older generations' expectations that you will address and solve the major environmental issues of the day. And every single time I ask that question, almost all of the hands in the room go up. Now, it's not a bad thing to be inspired, to feel encouraged and hopeful by the ways that young people today really are very aware and very active on climate and other environmental issues. That's not a bad thing. They are very inspiring, and they generally are very good at organizing, especially through social media. I think, though, it's important for older generations, and I count myself in that too. I'm a Gen Xer. Mm-hmm. I think that it's important for us to understand this should be an intergenerational fight. This is not just young people's fight. This is all of our fight. And there are ways that we can come together across those generational lines to really stand up for the climate fight together. And, you know, each generation has its different tools and resources. So maybe boomers are not necessarily going to lead with social media campaigns, although maybe you will. But I think it's important to really draw on the tools and resources that we have and to really partner across these generational lines, because we all have something to offer to each other.
You talk about environmental trauma, particularly in underserved communities, and that part of the healing of environmental trauma in underserved communities will involve an investment in mental health services. So could you talk a little bit about what that might look like?
Yeah, so I think that, well, first thing that we have to acknowledge is that as a nation, we are in a collective mental health crisis. Right. There's a lot of tension to the mental health crisis being experienced by children and teenagers, which is a very important part of that focus. But I think that we also need to understand that mental health services are not evenly distributed or evenly accessed by all members of society. And vulnerable or marginalized groups, particularly low-income communities and communities of color, have less access to mental health services, particularly to culturally competent, high-quality services. A lot of mental health care services are private, they are costly, and it makes it difficult for them to become accessible to people who may need them most. One of the things that I argue in this book is that there are climate activists, climate justice activists, whose work it is to sort of figure out, okay, what is being unevenly distributed to communities in terms of ways of dealing with climate change, becoming resilient, being able to adapt and respond, et cetera. And I think that one of the things that climate justice communities and activists and policymakers need to understand is that mental health is one of those resources. There are studies coming out of Hurricane Katrina after 2005 that showed that ongoing anxiety, depression, and in particular PTSD lingered in low-income communities and in Black communities in particular. And those communities were less likely to receive the services that they needed afterward. And I think that it's a really important opportunity to understand that if we know that these kinds of distressing mental and emotional outcomes occur after climate-related events, we can actually plan those services and their distribution better in a more proactive way.
And let's not forget the fact that even before climate change and climate anxiety took a hold, low-income and communities of color were already taking on the burden of environmental injustice, and the fact that there were lots of environmental issues associated with, say, lack of quality water to drink and sewage treatment systems and hazardous waste sites and an industry that were located in communities of color and low-income communities. So there's decades and generations of environmental burden that have been placed on these communities.
Absolutely. I think the difference is that in the in the recent focus on emotional and mental health outcomes, communities of color have been left behind. So the research hasn't really included communities of color in the studies, in the surveys, in the qualitative research. And because communities of color are being left behind in the research, it makes me feel very concerned that they will also be left behind when it comes to resource distribution. So you are absolutely right. And I think that longstanding evidence of ongoing environmental injustice should inform resource distribution, because there's more and more awareness that there will need to be emotional and mental health resources to help communities cope with ongoing climate disasters.
Well, just the last couple more minutes. I do have to say that a little shout out to our local Department of Health here in Summit County. They have recognized the growing impacts of climate change up here in Summit County and the impacts it's having on not just physical, but mental health. And they're offering a series of talks associated with climate change and its impacts on our, not just the environmental health, but our own physical and mental well-being. So there are efforts afoot, maybe here and maybe around the country, that more health departments or so are beginning to look at this issue a little stronger. Last minute or so, we always have, Claire and I always like to ask this question. Are you hopeful? Because I know Claire and I discuss these topics on a weekly basis. And we're shuttled off to a therapy many times right after the show. But not to be too flip, but do you remain hopeful about all the research and all the information you're getting and what you're seeing?
I'm very hopeful.
Okay.
I'm hopeful because there are more and more researchers that are doing this kind of work. They're documenting these emotional and mental impacts, and they're advocating for change in a way that's justice-centered. Mm. And that gives me a great deal of hope. And I'm in the struggle, too. And so taking action makes me feel hopeful as well.
And the work you do, obviously, and the books you write are part of the answer, I guess, going forward. Education and awareness about this issue, and the fact that there is hope, and there are ways to build resiliency with this issue.
I'm curious what you're working on now. What's next for you?
I actually have recently started new research that looks at the physical reproductive health impacts of climate change from a variety of lenses, both the impacts of oil and gas development on local communities, as well as the impacts of things like wildfire, air pollution, storms, various climate impacts. And I'm looking at how all of these things influence things like infertility, miscarriage, low infant birth weight, preterm birth. The next book will really be a specific policy-focused advocacy tool for mothers.
Right, and actually it harkens back to the interview we just had just talking about plastics and now micro and nanoplastics finding their way into literally on a cellular level. And that certainly has an impact on expecting moms and fetuses, et cetera. So it's chemicals across the board that are having brought, okay. So, well, the name of the book is Climate Anxiety and the Kid Question, Deciding Whether to Have Children in an Uncertain Future. Dr. Jade Sasser is the author. Dr. Sasser, do you have a website people can go to learn more about your work?
I do. JadeSasserPhD.com.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.